Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public service professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican John Kochelko, Democrat John McCarron, and Arthur Sear of Carthage College. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base, the National Radio Hall of Fame Gallery at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago. Nice to have you with us. Our toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289 if you'd like to email us a comment. Our email address is btb@museum.tv. And as always, if you'd like to watch or listen to this broadcast, you can do so at beyondthebeltway.com. That is our website. And again, we archive all of the shows. So if you miss us each week or a week, we have it for you for many, many weeks and years to come. Tonight, we're going to be opening up the phone lines. We'll be talking about a variety of things. Of course, in politics, the big news yesterday for the Republican nomination in the state of Nevada. They had a caucus yesterday, and with 71% of the precincts in at this time, Romney is at 48%, Newt Gingrich a distant second at 23%, Ron Paul at 19%, Rick Santorum at 11%. So that's the second state in a row where Romney has been victorious. And, of course, right now it's all about delegates. So as we look at the delegate count, the estimated pledge as of today, Mitt Romney has collected 81 delegates, Newt Gingrich 27, Rick Santorum 15, Ron Paul 6, and 1,144 is the magic number for the nomination. So the march continues. But tonight, for the next couple of hours, I want to talk about some things that and some issues that we really have not spent a great deal of time talking about thus far. And it seems to me that if you look over the last four presidential campaigns, that certainly is fresh in everyone's mind. At the beginning of a campaign, there are maybe one or two issues that you think are going to dominate. And clearly the issue of the economy and health care conceivably could dominate campaign 2012. But frequently there are issues that come out of either left field or right field, but they come out of nowhere, and they frequently can take over a campaign and dominate a campaign and in some cases affect it. Obviously, those things include background information about the candidate, like Jeremiah Wright dominated much of the campaign when it became public when Barack Obama was trying to introduce himself to the American people. So right at this moment, we think we know probably the two or three issues that are going to dominate. But I want to talk about a few others. And John McCarron, thanks very much. We're going to start with you. What's an issue that you think that isn't real high on everyone's radar right now, but you think that really could propel itself into a really hotly contested debate between the two parties?
Well, it's an issue top of my mind that I wish didn't exist, and that is the decision that was made last week by the Department of Health and Human Services regarding Obamacare or the Affordable Health Care Act. It needed to be decided what will and will not be on the menu of covered services in a standard health insurance policy. And the HHS decided that, yes, contraceptives will be or must be provided for. And no Catholic institutions such as hospitals, universities, and whatnot will not be exempted. They're going to be given an extra year to comply, but they must provide contraceptives as part of their health insurance plans for their employees. And of course, immediately, I think this became a huge opportunity, as we've seen from the Republican primaries. Everyone is trying to outdo themselves in their religiosity and their devotion.
Well, Newt has said specifically it's been a war on war on religion. He's
sure
used that for several weeks now.
Yeah, there'll be all sorts of hyperbole thrown at the president over this. I think it was, I mean, I've read that it was heavily discussed, the pros and the cons. And frankly, I think the president made the decision he did because it was the right thing to do.
All right. John Kochelko is our card-carrying Republican. What about that issue? How do you see that issue playing out politically?
Well, you know, the term hatred is often tossed around in American politics, particularly from the left. Conservatives are always accused of being people of hate. I think that the secular left truly hates the Catholic Church. And I think there are those in the administration who probably have a great deal of relish in issuing this directive because they know the pain that it's going to inflict on the Catholic Church. I think it's an incredibly stupid decision. I think that those who made it ought to go back and perhaps read the First Amendment, because there's more in the First Amendment than just the portions that the press approves of. And to attempt to force the Catholic Church to provide birth control and what is considered virtually abortion, the morning after pill, in opposition to the teachings of the church at their institutions is just unconscionable. The government should not be in the business of doing that.
Art Sear, your area of expertise is foreign policy, but again, and I'm going to ask everyone to come up with an issue just as I started the broadcast with John. So weigh in on this just from a political standpoint. Does this decision at this time make sense? Do you see it as a – obviously, Obama, the president, would not have done it if he didn't think it's a plus. Is it a plus or minus for him?
Well, I hesitate to, pretend to provide political insight because, as you say, I'm an academic. But I've been impressed by the informed commentary. Not only are liberal Catholics who have been supporting the administration left in the lurch, but also a lot of evangelicals, I gather, from reading the Sirius Press, have been moving toward Romney, which is an important phenomenon given hostility toward any Mormon on the part of some people in that population. There are also evangelicals even today who are Democrats by tradition and family heritage, not just in the South, but in border states, the Midwest, and certainly the Far West. And I think this could rebound to indirectly, but very in a very real sense, to help Romney.
I winced, Bruce, when you said that the president did it because he saw some advantage. I'm suggesting he did it because it was the right thing to do. That's a little different than there are so many votes on this side, so many votes on that side. And that, as for John, my esteemed Republican friend, saying that the press and liberals hate Roman Catholicism, I think that requires supernatural powers on your part, John, to be able to read the minds of...
Well, your side does that all the time. They're always accusing conservatives of hatred. We're constantly hearing conservatives being accused of being motivated by hatred. I think that the church's position on abortion and on gay rights inspires, yes, hatred on the part of some of the left. Not all liberals, not all Democrats, of course, but some... the hard left of the Democratic Party, I think, despises the Catholic Church and evangelical Christians as well. And I think that they rather fancy the idea of grinding the church down with an order such as this. I think they enjoy it.
John?
Well, I totally disagree. I think there are a majority of women in this country who see contraception as... vital to their health and the success of their family. What's more, it's a main way you cut down on abortions. And I think the last time I checked, the Catholic Church was against abortions even more than they're against contraception.
I want to follow up on that, give everybody an opportunity listening from coast to coast to sort of weigh in on this issue that John McCarron thinks might become a hot-button issue in this campaign. 1-800-723-8289. Do you believe that the Obama administration has a war against the Catholic Church and religion? Give us a call. Bruce Dumont back from the National Radio Hall of Fame. If you're coming to Chicago, we're open Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from 10 to 5 p.m., and we're talking this evening about some of the issues that may come out of nowhere to dominate the issue. And Art Sear, you had a comment on our issue involving contraceptive and new directive from the Obama administration.
I wouldn't use the word hatred, but, pouring oil on troubled waters, which is what any academic should do. I have a pretty good friend who is not only a successful academic, but also was successful for a period of years as a commentator on network television, a major network. And he made I'm not going to mention his name. He made the point to me that explicitly it's not hatred, but you don't find religious people in broadcasting as a rule. I'm not referring to present company necessarily at all, but he said people don't go to church. They don't go to synagogue. Religion is separate from their secular
existence.
Not just
broadcasting. I would say journalism.
Okay.
Not broadcasting.
Thank you for reinforcing that.
I mean, broadcasters actually you know, at least, you know, in the talk radio, they at least pretend that they go to church regularly.
Yes, and there are
not a lot of discussion.
Right.
Not a lot of discussion in religion in newsrooms, period.
That's right. And in The Making of the President, 1964, Theodore White's second less famous book, after celebrating JFK, he tried really hard to explain the Goldwater phenomenon, and he emphasized this: a secular media is really driving people to the right of the Republican Party.
What
and
do you
I
think about
that,
John?
There's been an echo of that without offending you. I think there's been an echo of that this evening.
John?
A secular media being the libertarian, the people who are basically...
ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, those...
Well, just, I mean, just, I mean, in your... in your distinguished career at the Tribune, 37 years, plus almost 37 years, how much discussion in the newsrooms has there been of religion? Is it discussed very often?
Yeah, it is, because of this kind of issue. It keeps coming up. I mean, we just had in Chicago recently, we had a there's a gay rights parade every spring, and they were going to parade down a street that goes in front of a Catholic church, and they complain, well, we won't be able to have mass that Sunday morning. It's always on a Sunday, and the so the bishop here, the cardinal, he started making comparisons between that and the Ku Klux Klan march against Catholics,
and he had to walk back.
Well, yeah, because it was a front page story for 3 days. That kind of thing keeps coming up. I will admit, newspapers like the Tribune used to have a religion editor. I don't think. They do anymore.
Bruce Bersema, right?
He had it at one time. Rudy Unger. It was more of a big thing. But I mean, the thing that gets covered, and it's usually covered as a he said, she said kind of thing. But typically, there's not a lot of advocacy one way or the other. Although interestingly, today, Sunday, the Tribune did have an editorial coming out saying this is a tough one. But ultimately, Obama should back down on the contraceptives for Catholic universities and hospitals.
But on this issue, as you bring it up, and I said to you, you know, why did – obviously Obama brought it up because he thought maybe there was some political gain, and you took exception to my comments like that. Here's why he may view that it is a it's a political plus. He may feel that on the economy – especially if he's running against Mitt Romney, he may feel that things are shaky on the economy. He doesn't necessarily want to lead with the economy and jobs because his record isn't that great there. So at this particular moment, as he looks at what moves people in the various swing states, he may prefer to have some discussion of morality, religion, abortion, you know, sort of the hot-button social issues that for an independent voter, frequently they are turned off maybe by a more conservative position that Republicans have. So he might view this as a wedge issue.
I doubt that very much.
Because he's not that Machiavellian, or
well, I certainly have some Machiavellians around him, but I doubt that he would see this as a potential winner for him. It's ugly now.
So
it's going to get a lot ugly.
So you're telling he's doing it because it's the right thing?
I think it's the right thing to
no
do, and I think from the one account I read of the inside the White House discussion, he was lobbied very hard on this by the women in the administration. I mean, this is a really important thing for women, access to contraception. Joe Biden, on the
and
other
Romney
hand—
Romney is running very well with women, we should say that. That in every race so far, he has run very well with women. So go ahead.
Against Gingrich.
Well, I was just going to say that Joe Biden, who of course is a Catholic, was arguing against, according to the unattributed article I read in the Wall Street Journal.
John,
you know, Mark Shields, who a very prominent commentator, a very staunch Democrat, very staunch liberal, was absolutely brutal in his critique of the Obama administration on this. He thinks it is stupid. I think that he also talked about the hostility that there is on the part of some in the left to the Catholic Church. William Buckley used to say that anti-Catholicism is the anti-Semitism of intellectuals. You could amend that today because I think there's a lot of real anti-Semitism amongst the left intellectuals in this country. But I think that that this is an issue in which if it's pursued, it can only be detrimental to the Obama administration. If they somehow think that offending the largest religious denomination in the United States is a wise political move, they're obviously wrong. And this transcends the issue of whether or not Catholic women practice birth control or not. And Mark Shields made that point. Whether or not Catholic women practice birth control, Catholics are not going to like the image of the Catholic Church being pushed around and intimidated by the federal government. That's going to strike a chord which Catholics across the spectrum are going
to
resent.
Though? It was the bishops who told the pastors to tell their prelates to read this statement from the pulpit last Sunday.
Well, you think they should keep it secret and not tell people what's going on, that this is bad for them to be informing people of what's going on? They should hide it from the faithful?
I certainly think they jumped in a little too soon. And I think, you know, that it gets back to a matter of science. I would go so far as to say that being against contraception, it begs a moral question, I think. The science is so strong on the side of women's health, so strong on the side of avoiding unwanted pregnancies and therefore avoiding abortions, that I really think morally the bishops are on the wrong side of this one.
Well, you know, whether or not you feel that the bishops are on the wrong side of it, they are putting into effect the teachings of the Catholic faith. And it's a fundamental principle of the United States that the government does not interfere with the teachings and the doctrines of religious groupings within the United States and compel them to do things which are against their strong moral values.
Where are you on polygamy or female genital mutilation or some other religious things that have been outlawed in
really,
this country?
Do you really think that that's a fair comparison? Do you really
think there's a lot
female
of
genital mutilation is in some way comparable to what we're talking
there
about?
There are a lot of religious practices that
I think that's really, really beyond the pale.
Art, if this discussion continues to grow in a political campaign, where does it lead? Does it become, as my question at the beginning of the broadcast, does it become a dominant issue? Does this become a dominant debate by getting the bishops and the Catholic Church and the administration and the women's groups and everybody churned up talking about this issue? You know, we've gone through the Republican primary with nary a word about the issue of abortion, which has frequently dominated a lot of Republican primaries in the last several years, and also even some general elections. We've come a long way without touching on that touchy issue of things that are hot button issues in people's lives. What did they do with their bodies, the control of their bodies?
Well, given the tenor of the discussion this evening, I think it might well become a much more
and these guys aren't even paid
issue.
They're not even paid politicians.
Maybe
they're just guys with differing passions. You throw some political skullduggery into this discussion, this could get very, very mean and nasty. And I think, you know, someone, you know, one thing, I think the analysis of the results yesterday in Nevada, which basically said that the evangelicals, for the second state in a row, Florida being the first, that Mitt Romney did better with evangelicals than Newt Gingrich. Oh. And that this was an example that although we've been reading for the last couple of years that a lot of evangelicals are not kind to Mormons and Mormonism, that this was going to be an albatross around Mitt Romney's neck, whereas what happened in Florida and what happened yesterday in Nevada, which has a number of Mormons in the state, in addition to the Mormons, it was also the evangelicals. Mm-hmm. They're swinging to Romney, and the interpretation is they're swinging to Romney because they now believe he is the most electable, and they no longer believe that Newt is electable.
Oh, I think that's
and one of the reasons why Newt continues to throw red meat out, and Newt is the one that's throwing the red meat out about this issue. He's the one that's talking about the war against the Catholic Church and war against religion. Romney isn't bringing that up, obviously, because he'd rather talk about the economy.
Well, thank you for asking me to answer your initial question. I am glad that John McCarron made the point that maybe the president thinks it's the right thing to do that may well be the case because he's not facing a challenge on the left. Democratic presidents generally do, within the party or, in Clinton's case, a third party with Ross Perot. I think JFK would had he lived. Lyndon Johnson didn't in 64 but did in 68. There's usually a challenge from the left. Obama's not facing that, rather surprisingly, given the way he's moved to the center and on national security, the right, if you will. So it may well be that the president thinks it's the right thing to do.
Okay, we'll see if your reaction to that. 1-800-723-8029. We've got some callers on the line. We will bring them into the conversation when we roll on from Chicago. And we're going to ask our other two guests to come up with some issues that they think are way, way out in the weeds that may be pressed to the front burner. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dubot back from the National Radio Hall of Fame Gallery in Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us this evening. Our liberal Democrat tonight is John McCarron. For 30-plus years, he has been a columnist and now a contributing columnist for the Chicago Tribune, was on the editorial board for many, many years, the pride of the great state of Rhode Island, and a Roman Catholic. 12 years of K through 12. K through, and you're still on the... Still on the train, or are you a fallen Catholic?
An occasional Catholic, I guess you'd
An occasional call that. Catholic.
I'm sort of in and out. I mean, a lot of the doctrines in the catechism that I learned, I no longer believe.
Okay. And John Kuchelko also joins us, a longtime political operative and elected official in Cicero, which is a suburb to the west of Chicago, and also a gentleman who does historic impressions of great American presidents and has been a guest on this program, also a political historian. And you two are a practicing Roman Catholic.
Yes, I am.
You practice a little more than John.
Well, Bill Buckley used to call himself a strict and orthodox Roman Catholic, and that would describe me as well, a strict and orthodox Roman Catholic.
Okay, so you still agree with all the catechisms, the ones that John wants to throw out?
Yes, I do.
And Art Sear joins us, and he is a Protestant, right. And we normally don't introduce people to their religion. He is the A.W. Clausen Professor at Carthage College. And, again, always a good guest on this program.
Thank you.
And we have callers on the line. Let us go to Brian, listening to us in Roselle, Illinois, on our flagship station, WLS Radio, the radio home of Bruce Wolf and Dan Proft. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, Bruce and panelists. You know, I'm Irish Catholic heritage, and I'd like to point out the fact that most Americans are what they call cafeteria Catholics. They pick and choose the parts of Catholicism that they want to follow. And I think if you analyze it, most American Catholic women practice birth control that the Pope would not approve of. And, you know, people that think that Catholics all march in lockstep are badly mistaken. And the only thing that's keeping the Catholic Church vital and alive in America is all the Mexican, Hispanic immigrants and the Polish immigrants. And that's it, because the native-born Americans are not keeping the Catholic Church vital. And then I also wanted to comment on...
Stay on the line for Brian. Hold on for a second. I'm going to give you a chance to do your follow-up question. But I want to get to John Kuchelko's assessment of your analysis of the health of the Catholic Church.
Well, I'm a native-born American Roman Catholic, as were my parents, and so I believe that the statement that native-born Catholics have somehow drifted away from the faith, I don't think that's true at all. I think there's been a great revival in the
Church.
Well,
he didn't say all.
Well,
but his point was that the influx of Mexican and those from Eastern Europe, that maybe they represent the growth potential for the Church. Is there some numerical
I think they are bringing numbers to the Catholic population in the United States, but that's not to suggest that all of the various ethnic strains that make up Catholicism in the United States aren't still there and aren't still active in the Church. Irish and Italian and Polish and German Americans and all the other nationalities that make up the Church. So I wouldn't accept that idea. And the point is, I'm aware of the fact that surveys show that Catholic women practice birth control. That's not the point. The point is that even those who may individually disagree with the teachings of the church are not going to like the idea of the church being forced to knuckle under to a directive from the administration. It's like the old story of, you know, you may disagree with your brother. You may think your brother is a jerk, but let someone outside criticize your brother, and you're going to defend him to the hilt. And I think that's the same.
John, phenomenon. Before we go back to Brian for his next question, describe for us what John just described as sort of knuckling under. What does this new directive, what does it actually do? Can you give a little specificity to it?
The church itself would be exempt from providing insurance that includes contraception. Okay, so if you work for the Archdiocese of Chicago, you're exempted. However, church hospitals, church universities, church not-for-profit organizations, I'm thinking maybe Catholic Charities.
If I work for a Loyola Hospital in Chicago,
right.
Major Catholic hospital,
right.
What would I have to do under this new directive?
Your group health insurance plan would have to cover contraception. It's simple as that. I think that also you don't have to. You
and
would have
if
no copay.
I chose not to do that, what would happen to me?
I don't know. I don't know what the sanctions are. There are sanctions. There are financial sanctions. Some people say they're ruinous, but I don't know the dollar figures. By the way, I think the Catholic Church does many wonderful things. I agree with the caller that Americans, I think by their nature, are sort of anti-authoritarian. So when someone tells them you will do this and you will do that, there is a tendency to pick and choose for what they think makes sense and what does not. But let me tell you, this country probably couldn't survive without Catholic schools, without Catholic hospitals and whatnot. I mean,
and without Catholic
enormous,
charities.
Without
charities.
Religious
yes.
charities in general.
Well, yeah. And I mean, look what here in Chicago, what Catholic schools have meant for neighborhoods. They've been hugely important. They're like the original charter schools.
Well, when a church, any church, not just the Catholic Church, when you are accepting dollars from a federal government or even a state government to perform services that aren't necessarily directly related to religion, but they are performing a public function, with the power of the purse string comes the power to yank the purse string every once in a while. Is that okay? I mean, now, speak as a Catholic and speak as a taxpayer.
Well, that's not
necessarily one and the same. I mean,
that's not the issue in this particular case.
I know that,
this has to do with everyone being required to do this. One in every hospital patients in the United States today is in a Catholic hospital. So Catholic hospitals are a huge factor in health care in the United States. This is going to be a tremendous issue.
One out of how many?
One out of six. So the fact of the matter is that what you've described is something that, as I understand it, the church simply cannot agree to. These hospitals and other institutions may not be formally part of the dioceses or archdioceses, but they are under the authority of those archdioceses, and they ultimately have to follow the directives of their bishop or their archbishop. And they simply are not – I cannot see how they can comply with this. They've said, in effect, if we don't comply with it, we're violating the law. If we do comply with it, we're violating the teachings of the Catholic faith. It's an impossible choice for a Catholic to make.
Brian, your second question.
You were talking or discussing what could come out of the blue and affect this presidential election that's coming up. I think it's going to be a major war in the Middle East. I think the Israelis are going to do the calculus and figure that Barack Obama most likely will beat Mitt Romney, and they will go ahead and strike Iran. And I think that's going to drag us into the war, and it's going to be a major, messy war with more dire consequences than most Americans realize, and it's going to consume everything probably late spring, midsummer. I think that's really going to happen.
Okay. Thanks very much for that. It leads me to Art Sear, who I was going to ask to sort of put on the table of the issue that you think is going to come out of nowhere to sort of dominate this presidential campaign. And let's do so by responding to Brian's suggestion that obviously it isn't necessarily a big surprise that a problem could come out of the Middle East.
No, there are always problems in the Middle East.
But specifically, he's talking about an Israeli strike against Iran.
Yeah, there's actually a fair amount of speculation in the media that, based primarily on an interview that former Prime Minister and current Defense Minister Ehud Barak gave last November that hasn't been much discussed, I'm glad we are, that there's a 6 to 9 month window after which Iran will become relatively invulnerable to an attack. So I think it basically turns on the degree to which the U.S. can serve as a restraint on Israel. I hope the Israelis don't calculate their national security based on what a U.S. administration would do. Despite all the heated rhetoric, Republicans trying to one-up each other in their support for Israel, my guess is that there's probably not a lot of difference between our current president and, say, President Romney concerning Iran. A President Gingrich would be very different. It's important to keep in mind that
what would be, in your view, the principal difference between a President Romney and a President Gingrich on this issue?
I think President Gingrich is quite unpredictable. He's been much more explicit in stating that he thinks Iran is a threat whether or not they have nuclear weapons. And someone that hard to predict might well decide to launch a strike against Iran. I don't pretend to predict the future, but my basic point is I'm a lot more unsure about what someone like him would do in the White House than, say, our current president, President Obama, or a President Romney, which we may well have.
Today on the Chris Matthews Show, the question that was discussed was whether or not the Republican candidates, all three of them that are including, with the exception of Ron Paul, whose foreign
Important
policy
exception.
Is a little bit different. But any of the three, could they, in the course of the debates and the discussions, could they somehow force President Obama into a similar position that he would have to support and give support and moral support to an Israeli strike?
No, I don't think so. I don't think the out-of-power party candidate, American history, argues quite the contrary, that I don't think President Obama would feel much pressure from that side. Another point to keep in mind.
Do you think he would do it?
What?
I mean, from his own political perspective, do you think that if there were a strike mm-hmm. by the Israelis and that takes out the nuclear capability of Iran, and I'll let you, we're going to a commercial break.
Right.
I won't give you time to think
Thank
about
Thank you
it.
Very much I, for I that
want,
question.
I want to get your thoughts on how President Obama would respond to it. I want to get everybody else's response to it
Enough.
As well. How would President Obama respond if the Israelis attacked Iran? Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. We'll be going back to calls in just a moment, but I do want to make a public announcement for those people watching us in Chicago and also listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio. As you all know, this past week, Don Cornelius, the creator of Soul Train, took his life at age 75, and this coming Wednesday night, there will be a public memorial service here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications at 360 North State, WVON Radio and V103 and the U, WCIU, which is where that show got its start. We will hold and present a public opportunity for people to come and pay tribute to really a remarkable broadcast entrepreneur, a man that followed a dream when he was a young man. He was an insurance man. He wanted to be on the radio, wanted a career in broadcasting. WVON gave him an opportunity to go on the air. Then he wanted to move over to TV. WCIU was the place where he had an opportunity to develop a television career. One day he came in with an idea for a show called Soul Train. It was a show he felt would address the black culture, the black teenagers growing up in America, that they didn't really have a niche for them to fit in. And Howard Shapiro, who was running the station at that time, gave him an opportunity to start the show. About a year later, it went into national syndication. 2 years later, it was up to 25 markets, and again, it really is one of the most successful syndicated television programs of all time, again, created by a great Chicagoan who has now left us, unfortunately, given the tragedy of his life, Don Cornelius. And again, this coming Wednesday night at 1 o'clock, I'm sorry, at 6 p.m., that's 6 p.m., we will have a public memorial service for Don Cornelius, and it will be carried live also on WVON Radio. Let us go back to calls. Let us go to Susan, listening to us in Chicago on WLS. Go ahead.
Hi. That mandate coming down from President Obama and Kathleen Sebelius about insurance policies for Catholic institutions, yeah, they must include sterilization, contraception, but the abortion morning after pill, Ella, that is a source of controversy right there. And that's according to the Illinois Family Institute. You know, two Easters ago when Obamacare was passed in the House, didn't the president promise those five pro-life Democrats for their votes there'd be no abortion funding? Or what happened there? He was going to issue an executive order, no abortion use of the Obamacare bill.
Do you recall the specifics of it? I know that there was a deal made. I think it was a congressman from Pennsylvania that was
right.
involved.
And I do recall that, the notion that nothing in this bill would in any way impact on abortion, and there were guarantees to that effect to get the necessary votes from I think, several Catholic Democrats in the run-up to the vote for that.
Is that a broken promise?
Probably.
It also may point toward a potential compromise out there that they might agree to allow contraception, but not morning after, not post-conception.
Mm-hmm. Susan, let me ask you, you called in on this particular issue. I want to get your reaction to the other sort of potential surprise issue that our previous caller brought up and our Sir was talking about, and that is whether or not or how the president would respond if Israel were to lead a strike against Iran. First of all, as a voter, what would you think if Israel were to launch an attack like that? What should the position of the United States be? Should we be shocked? Should we be encouraging? What should we do?
Oh, my. Israel has a right to defend herself, to survive. And I certainly wouldn't prevent Israel from doing it. I would allow her to do it. That is the way I feel.
Art Sear, what is the precedent that would be set if that happened and we congratulated Israel?
I don't think we should congratulate Israel. I think the caller actually had a very good answer, given that she probably wasn't reflecting on that issue before we asked the question. I think I don't think Israel is going to attack unless the United States gives tacit approval privately. The precedents are the strike against Syria to take out a facility that the North Koreans were helping them build within the last couple of years, and the 1981 strike against Iraq. I do believe the U.S. Didn't encourage but collaborated with Israel, especially at the intelligence level, with both those attacks. I hope that Israel wouldn't attack unless we approved privately. Our general approach has been to say very little. I think that's a good approach. Two other closely related points to keep in mind. Number one, Iran has been very, very cautious about using military force beyond their borders. Given the way Washington officials are beating the drums of hostility to Iran, I think that's important to keep in mind. They tolerated weapons of mass destruction attacks from Iraq during their lengthy war in the 80s without responding in kind. Secondly, the economic sanctions, as our officials rightly stress, are taking a heavy toll on Iran.
John Kuchelko.
Oh, I respectfully have a very different point of view on that. For the United States, an Iranian nuclear capability is a matter of national security. For Israel, it's a matter of national survival. They know that the president
of Iran... That's why I gave that background. I don't disagree with that.
The president of Iran has said that Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth. The supreme leader just a couple of days ago said that Israel is a cancer that should be removed.
They're characterized by overblown rhetoric. We'd be highly irresponsible if we made policy based on what particular Arab or other leaders in the Middle East said bombastically in public. That's not a recipe for wise policy.
The problem that I have with that is that's what people said about Adolf Hitler in the 1920s and 30s. They said he really doesn't mean this.
Right.
This is just politics. It's just for public.
I don't want to insult you, John, but in high school debate, a very good rule is the first side that brings up Hitler loses.
Well, I don't subscribe to that rule.
I think that's a good rule.
I was a high school debater, and I don't subscribe to that rule.
Well, if I thought we were facing this next Adolf Hitler, I'd agree with you, but I don't think we are, obviously.
Well, we do.
But let me ask one quick question, then we'll let you guys debate in the next hour. Sure. Nikita Khrushchev, who said, "I will bury you"? Wasn't that political rhetoric for?
Yeah, he must have been. He must have been the next Adolf Hitler,
well,
right?
Khrushchev,
we should have launched the preemptive strike.
Khrushchev was talking. Everyone knows that he was talking economically. He was arguing economics with.
No, he
Nixon.
Set off a 50-megaton warhead in the background of saying, "We will bury you." Sorry about that. He was constantly threatening to destroy us.
And that's one of the reasons that the United States took the position it did when Kennedy
we'll
did the missile crisis.
We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen. We've lit a fuse, and we'll keep it going next hour. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, coming to you from Chicago with Republican commentary tonight from John Kuchelko, Democrat John McCarron, and Arthur Sear, distinguished professor from Carthage College. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And again, go to the website. It's beyondthebeltway.com. In the last hour, we were talking about some of the issues that may come out of nowhere to dominate the campaign and the recent decision by the Obama administration on contraception involving Catholic hospitals dominated some of our first hour's discussion and how it might become a dominant issue. And Art Sear was talking about the fact that any Israeli strike against Iran of the Middle East is always a combustible part of the world that could come out of nowhere. And so John Kuchelko, who is our Republican tonight. John, you've had the whole hour to think about an issue or two that you think will come from nowhere and potentially could sort of, you know, end up as a lively discussion point between now and November and swing some votes. What is it?
Well, I think that one issue that may arise, I don't know that it will be as big an issue as the obvious issues of the economy and the budget problems, but national defense. I think that national defense is always an issue that Republicans feel is important. I know that the Obama administration, and particularly their fans in the media, have been peddling the notion that he has been a superb commander-in-chief and has all these victories under his belt. I don't see that. I don't acknowledge that. And I think that with the deep cuts that the defense secretary recently presented, Leon Panetta, deep cuts in defense spending for the years going forward, I think that this is an issue that could be raised. And certainly if anything happens in the Middle East, national defense will come to the forefront, and I think would work to the advantage of Republicans advocating a more robust foreign policy.
John McCarron, do you think the president has weakness on national defense?
No, I don't, but I do think it's another indication what John said, that Republicans are for austerity, except when it comes to the defense contracting industry, and then it's it's bombs away, so to speak. I was reading today where, we're going to take 7,000 troops out of Europe, leaving only 37,000 troops in Europe. You know, when I look at the Ron Paul crowds, the young people, especially veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Writing checks to Ron Paul.
Writing checks to Ron Paul, I think that's the pulse of where America is at right now in terms of military. If anything, I think maybe they're going a little overboard in terms of isolationism, but I just don't think it's going to really profit Mitt Romney or anybody else to stand up there, as he continues to do, and pound and say we're going to be so strong that no one will dare, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, come on. I mean, what happened to the budget deficit and the national debt?
Art Sear.
I agree with John, and also John, I think defense is going to be a major issue. Since September 11, the Republican Party has been, and actually since the Vietnam era, but especially since September 11, the Republican Party has been seen as the party better able to defend America. Even in 2008, when the Democrats had an edge in just about everything, not just the usual education and social services issues, on defense, the Republicans were seen as stronger. Obama's been addressing that by keeping Bob Gates unprecedented, keeping Bob Gates on as defense secretary from the Bush administration, but also being much more aggressive in going after terrorists.
Yeah, but I just want to go back to that. You say you sort of poo-poo what the president has been able to do as the commander in chief. He's got to take some credit for it. I mean, he did make some significant decisions. I mean, he did get Bin Laden. He did get much of the leadership of Al Qaeda. There was the brilliant raid just a couple of weeks ago involving the Navy SEALs.
Now, he didn't do it in Somalia.
But again, he was the one that gave the order. He's doubled the drone attacks in the Pakistani border. You can't say that he's weak in pursuing at least the war on terror. At least in those areas, in the big broad issues of whether or not he has protected the American people, I think the vast majority of people who aren't professional Obama haters would say he's done a pretty good job, certainly a better job than most Democrats would have done in the past.
See, I have
acknowledged that any of that.
Some of it. I have a different perspective on it. We haven't faced a real direct threat. There's been nothing comparable to the missile crisis or comparable to September 11th on his watch thus far. So he hasn't had to deal with a crisis of that type. I'm always interested in the fact that Obama takes the bows for the eliminating of Bin Laden and the killing of other al-Qaeda leaders. All those programs began under the Bush administration. Now, the Obama people tell us that the economy is all Bush's fault, that all started under Bush, and he has no responsibility for that. But when other programs begun by Bush bear results, as with the death of Bin Laden, they're eager to step forward and take the bows for that. My feeling is that American intelligence found Bin Laden, and the American military killed him. And I don't see where the lion's share of the credit, or even the credit that's been given by some to Barack Obama, is appropriate. I just don't see that.
Because the ultimate decision, John, just as George Bush would have gotten the ultimate accolades if it happened on his watch, whoever is the president who makes the call, they get credit for that.
And we know from the lesson of Jimmy Carter that when you make that decision, things can go wrong.
Right.
I believe that President Obama, in fairness to him, did invite former President Bush to join him in the announcement of the killing, and the Bush people declined.
Right.
But, I do remember that when we found Saddam Hussein, I don't remember many Democrats stepping forward to heap praise on George W. Bush at that time. I don't remember that he got any praise from the Democrats, and I don't remember the media offering a great deal in the way of plaudits to Bush. There's always a double standard in this.
Saddam was not involved in 9/11.
Yeah. Well, Saddam
Hussein was not Bin Laden.
The point is,
he's bagged a couple of major terrorists. The world is better. If you believe that by breaking up al-Qaeda and certainly greatly diminishing its power, if you think that is striking a blow on the war against terrorism, then President Obama deserves a lot of credit for what he did, period.
I think he deserves credit for continuing the policies that were begun by President Bush. I will certainly give him credit for that.
Keeping, in my view, and I know John would disagree with this, but keeping Guantanamo open when he was going to get rid of it. Where did that issue go?
But he was free.
Basically a lot of things that he wanted. Basically a lot of things that he was criticizing. He has kept the Bush policies alive and well.
Guantanamo was not – certainly that doesn't represent what he wanted. He was forced by Congress to do that. They wanted to move all of the inmates from Guantanamo to the States, and they found out that there was no will in Congress to bring them anywhere in the United States proper.
So we know that a candidate saying anything in a campaign is likely to change their mind once they see the reality.
Should have closed Guantanamo, moved him to Illinois. We need the jobs here in Illinois. We had a prison all ready to go for him, and irrational Republican opposition killed the deal.
1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Telephone number 1-800-723-8029 if you'd like to join us. We're talking about a variety of issues that may come up and dominate the campaign. And, John, you wanted to make a point because we were talking about that, at least I was making the point that I think that President Obama should get a lot of credit for getting bin Laden and some of the other leadership, major leadership of al-Qaeda, and also for the ongoing, you know, drone attacks. I mean, twice as many drone attacks than President Bush was using.
Well, I saw a woman this past summer with a T-shirt that said, Obama got Osama. And I found that to be an exaggeration. I'd just like to make a historical footnote. In 1943, American intelligence located Admiral Yamamoto, the Japanese officer who was the mastermind of the attack on Pearl Harbor, so in many ways comparable to Osama bin Laden. He was going to be flying into an inspection tour of Japanese facilities in the South Pacific. And so U.S. Army Air Force interceptors reached his flying convoy and shot down the aircraft with Admiral Yamamoto, killing him. Nobody began walking around with T-shirts saying FDR got Yamamoto. And if anyone had tried to suggest, I think, that Franklin Roosevelt had personally been responsible for the death of Yamamoto, I think FDR would have batted that away. I think I can just hear FDR saying, you know, the credit goes to our distinguished fighting men in uniform. I don't think he would have accepted the credit, and I think it's a little bit unseemly for Barack Obama, as at the State of the Union message, to be sort of, you know, thumping on the lectern and reminding everyone at the beginning of the speech and then again at the end of the speech about his role in this. I think it's unseemly for the President of the United States to be taking that measure of credit for the credit that should go to our intelligence agencies and to our military.
Do you have an Obama impersonation in your repertoire?
No, I don't.
Oh.
No, I don't.
Because I thought that the president, at least maybe not in this State of the Union, but I thought that the president has been very magnanimous in talking about, you know, the Navy SEALs that really and met with them and talked with them and being in contact with them and having them to the White House.
The operation to bring down Yamamoto, which certainly should be praised and was called Operation Vengeance. I'm very glad that our leaders, especially those in the executive branch, have not been using that term these days. I'm very grateful we're not in a total war. John's absolutely right to underscore the distinctions involved.
One of the other issues that has gotten too much publicity in recent months, but again, I think is going to come back up if the job numbers don't continue to go up, and that is the president's decision to kill the Keystone Pipeline. Was that a smart move or a dumb move in your view, John?
I think it was a very bad move. I think that Canada is one of our closest of all of our friends and allies, and now the Canadians, who have a great deal invested in this project, are talking about selling some of this petroleum to the Chinese, for God's sakes. I think that it would create jobs, and apparently one of the real problems for the Obama administration is that most of these jobs would be created in states that have the bad taste to vote Republican. And that's one of the, I think one of the reasons why they've dragged their feet on giving approval to this. I think it would be an excellent
idea.
I
think that's absurd. I think eventually this pipeline is going to get built. I think what you saw is, for one, you had a Republican governor from the state of Nebraska saying, please don't hurry up and approve this, at least under the original route of the pipeline, because it runs across these sand hills that are like a direct filtration system down to something called the Ogallala Aquifer. And I took physical geography in college, so I know what an aquifer is. Aquifer is a porous strata of rock that holds water. And most of the dry land agriculture that occurs west of the Missouri River up to the Rockies is based on irrigation. Drawn from the Ogallala Aquifer. So you have, about five, plain states depend on the purity and the availability of the Ogallala Aquifer. Republican governor says, let's hold off on this, figure another route. Meanwhile, the president, as you remember, late last year, we were engaged in this congressional fight over extending the payroll tax cut, and the Republicans threw in a requirement that Obama rule on the Keystone within 60 days. A requirement. I mean, that had nothing to do with with the payroll tax cut. So Obama, within 60 days, came out with a temporary ruling, saying we're not gonna approve this until we figure out if the realignment works. That's where it stands now. Republicans are saying it's an anti-job move, and he's caving into the environmentalists. I don't believe that.
Well, I certainly believe that. I think that he was playing to his environmentalist base. He's constantly talking about the need to create more jobs, but obviously was not interested in jobs in this particular instance. And the Republicans wanted to get him off the dime. It would be nice if occasionally he did something,
except
if he made a decision and did
Nebraska,
something.
Except the governor of the state that it was going to go through,
There's a difficulty with the one state of Nebraska, but all the others are in line. There's some talk that the Canadians may be able to proceed with American support in most of the other states that are involved in this. But I still think it was an unwise decision.
Do you think you've been following and writing in your Scripps Howard syndicated column, Art?
Thank you, Bruce.
About the campaign as it unfolds. Do you notice a maturing of Mitt Romney during this process? Is he getting better?
He's a better debater than he was 4 years ago. He still has this tendency, which I'm sure the Obama campaign is analyzing in great detail, and we'll see some probably pretty devastating announcements, this tendency to misspeak and say not what he means. I'm sure he cares about poor people in a compassionate way. But he has a way of talking like a corporate elitist that could, in fact, do him in what now looks like a tough presidential campaign.
Is that different than
a lot better.
Professorial elitist?
Absolutely.
And how do they differ?
A corporate elitist can really turn off voters. I don't think professors have that much.
Oh, really?
I've elected many.
Art,
John Connolly.
I tend to disagree.
Let's go for a walk down the street today.
All right. Since you opened the door, please give me a chance for equal time response. John Connolly raised $20 million, which was a lot of money back in 1980. Got one delegate from South Carolina. He dropped out before he was supposed to speak at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, where I used to work.
Right.
He lined up CEOs. They got in line behind him. We wanted to organize receptions for George Herbert Walker Bush. They're out of touch.
But Ronald Reagan, you've told this story 100 times on this
show.
No. We've heard it 100 times. Mike, the question I asked is a professorial elitist any different than a corporate elitist?
Are you, not you personally? No, I'm not.
But
elitist,
are your
Bruce.
Colleagues any more in touch with what the average guy wants than the president of a Fortune 500 company?
I think it varies. But as a group, outside of Republicans beating up on teachers, going beyond the poor old professors for political gain, I don't think there is the same kind of resonance. Which is, you interrupted me when I was going to say Ronald Reagan would not meet with corporate leaders. And he made it very clear in Chicago briefly that you're dead if you do that.
Right.
Connolly, especially if you're a Republican. Besides, they're coming to me, Mr. Sear. They're smelling the scent. I'm a winner. So they're starting to contact me. I don't have to contact them. What I have to contact is the average worker.
John?
Well, I think the key point about John Connolly is that timing is everything. And he had the misfortune of running in the same year that Ronald Reagan was running. I think that has a lot more to do with the failure of John Connolly connect with the voters than the fact that he was a wealthy guy. I don't think that had really that much to do with
it. No, he was spending his time with the rich. He was spending his time in boardrooms,
country clubs. Was the average voter aware of that, how he spends his time?
That's what Ronald Reagan told me. You're reinforcing my point, John.
I don't think Ronald Reagan
understood this about the average American. John Connolly was clueless. Lyndon Johnson, I have it on good authority, used to say that, you know, my friend John is about the smartest man I've ever met, really able, but he can't talk to anybody who's not wearing a $1,000 suit. And this was 50 years ago.
I'm your liberal Democrat tonight, Bruce, and I hope from my lips to Dave Axelrod's ears that they don't make a big deal out of these slips of tongue that Mitt Romney has made. I just think that would be cheap for them to try to seize on those out of context remarks that the $10,000 bet.
But they will.
They should. I'm not going totally soft, but let me tell you what they should seize on. They should seize on bank accounts in the Cayman Islands. They should seize on bank accounts in Switzerland. Seize on a 13.9% effective tax rate.
Are they against the law?
No, they're not. These are serious policy issues. tax avoidance by the rich is a serious policy issue, and they should go hard on that and make him defend tax avoidance by the rich. Legal tax avoidance.
Can I ask where was this sentiment on the part of Democrats during all the years of the Kennedy dominance of the party? You know, they just sold they talked about the Kennedy compound at Hyannisport, and the main house is going to be converted into a museum. How many ordinary Americans lived in a compound during those years? But I don't remember that the enormous wealth of the Kennedys ever bothered the Democratic Party.
It's very hypocritical. As long as they paid their capital gains or whatever, I mean, that's fine. I mean, Democrats, I don't think, are against success.
You're suggesting Romney didn't pay his taxes?
We're against gaming the tax laws.
Obeying the tax laws?
Gaming.
Following
the
tax laws?
Is it gaming or obeying?
Obeying the tax
laws. Well, so we then need a debate on whether people who make millions of dollars ought to be taxed at 15% instead of the 30% that's paid by the people who work for them.
If the Democrats think they're going to win this election by saying that Romney's a rich guy, I think they're headed for disaster. I think the soak the rich crowd is already in the Democratic camp. I don't think they're going to gain many votes by going with the soak the rich approach
or hatred of the rich. There is a pay your taxes crowd, though.
And I think Romney's done that. He's paid an awful lot of taxes from what I saw, an enormous amount of taxes.
And he's also given a lot away.
He has. He comes out high on the charity mark.
1-800-723-8029. We've got callers on the line. We'll bring them in when we come back to Chicago. From Burlington, Vermont to Burlington, Iowa, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's Great Talk radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM Satellite Radio. Nice to have you with us this evening. Art Sear is here. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College. That is in Kenosha, Wisconsin. After the Cold War is the name of his book that he wrote many years ago about Europe. And also, our liberal tonight is John McCarron. He is an adjunct professor at DePaul University. Also, for 30-plus years, he has been a columnist, now a contributing columnist for the Chicago Tribune, longtime member of their editorial board for a long period of that time, and also a business editor.
I was financial editor.
Financial editor, but your claim to fame, I think most people who grew up in Chicago, who've been reading the Tribune, you are an urban affairs expert.
I do, and I could never quite explain to my editors what exactly that meant.
Spent a lot of time talking about cities.
Planning, housing, zoning, demographics, trends in cities and suburbanization.
And John Kochelko also joins us. Once upon a time, he was an elected official in Cicero. He was also a state representative. How many years in Springfield for you, John?
Just 2-year term in the House of Representatives, but it was a great experience.
Was that enough, or did the voters turn you out?
No, the remapping.
The remap
I was remapped out of a district. It was impossible.
So the Democrats decided to erase you.
Yeah, they cut my town into 5 districts. Cicero was carved into 5 separate House districts and 4 Senate districts. So
And also a historian.
Yes.
By training.
I'm proud of it. Yeah, a master's degree in history, doctoral candidate. Came very close to receiving the PhD. Didn't finish my doctoral dissertation.
Mm-hmm. And what is your general impression of the question that I asked Art Sear about whether or not professors – well, let me ask you this question. The general perception of most people is that all professors are, or the mass majority of academia, is left of center. Would you agree with that, and if so, why?
Oh, that's certainly true. My experience of the faculty of the universities that I attended was overwhelmingly liberal. And those were relatively conservative institutions, DePaul University, for example. But there were a couple of conservative members of the history department faculty when I was there. But the general tone of the departments that dealt with public affairs was decidedly liberal. And I'm sure when you go to the more prominent, you know, the East Coast, the Ivy League universities, conservatives have a very rough time in the academic environment.
Why is that?
I think that this goes back, I think, to the New Deal. I think the American intellectual, the American academic world shifted rather decidedly to the left during the New Deal. They were very, very fond of Franklin Roosevelt and moved to the left, and I think it's only intensified since then. I think Vietnam, the whole hostility to Vietnam, I was in college during that time, and, of course, that moved a lot of the academic community to the left, I believe, the hostility to American military involvement in Vietnam. And I think it's just it's intensified since then with environmental issues, feminism. I think that the academic community has been in the forefront of so many of those. And I think it's something that, that Republicans have to be aware of, because the overwhelming strength of liberals on the academic world is a factor they have to deal with, just like the entertainment industry and the journalism business. I look upon those as sort of the three pillars of support for the left that are beyond the reach of the voters. There's nothing the voters can do about the media, the entertainment industry, or the academic world.
Art, do you agree with that assessment of academia? You've spent much of your last 20-plus years in academia. Would you agree
since,
with that assessment
nine,
that,
since
it's,
98,
that,
although
that it's
I
left
thought,
of center?
Yeah, I basically agree with John, but I would also caution that old guys like John and me and maybe one or two of the other gentlemen at the table should beware of becoming out of date. Students to a remarkable degree are choosing business careers today. A lot of them are liberal arts majors. I also think that the radicalism of the 60s included Vietnam, but it was really a worldwide phenomenon that represented wider forces. Certainly the New Deal was important, but I think this image of academics is subject increasingly to change. John and I are also talking, just to finish the sentence, John and I are also talking about people in the liberal arts, social sciences, humanities, the arts. I think it's a very different phenomenon in the natural sciences and more vocational education.
Well,
Sorry, John.
I just wanted to say that I made no mention of the student body. I was talking about the academic, the professoriate. I'm talking about those in academic positions. I made no reference to that. There was during the 80s, there was a sense that students had become more conservative. I've talked to some of my former professors who bemoaned the fact that students were not as liberally inclined during the 80s and 90s as they had been previously.
So what you and I are saying, John, is that professors don't have that much impact ideologically, which means the average worker, especially out there who's listening and wants to learn, the kind of person that Reagan appealed to, should think about that point, because it flies in the face against a lot of the fear generated by this notion that academia is full of liberals.
I'm not supporting what you said. I think that many students come to the universities conservative, and they may enroll in conservative professions such as business and economics, but they are still exposed to this overwhelming avalanche of liberalism from their professors, and it does have an effect. I think that there's been many studies that show that students graduating have moved politically to the left, regardless of what their major may have been, regardless of the views they brought to the university. So you're misconstruing what I said. I'm not suggesting that it is not something where the professors have an impact on the students.
You think students are becoming more liberal or not? You said before they were more conservative.
No. I did not say that. I said that there was some sense on the part of professors that the students arriving at the universities weren't as motivated as they had been in the 60s. But that doesn't mean that when they spend 4 years studying at the feet of liberals that they're not going to be impacted by that. And there have been plenty of studies that show that they do.
What about you speak to the journalism profession?
Well, I think the journalism
profession. Most of them are left of center.
No, I wouldn't stipulate to that. You know,
not even
center,
most.
Center is moving. I mean, from what I hear watching these Republican primaries, the center is moving rapidly to the right, if that's any indication. No, I think journalism still clings to that he said, she said formula of neutrality. That's still the holy grail, if anything, because and I've gone on one of my pet peeves here, because government has an obligation to disclose, because there's an Open Meetings Act, because there's a Freedom of Information Act. Government is now sort of the low-hanging fruit in terms of investigative reporting. So our papers are full of scandals after scandals about boards of education and city councils and people who hire their relatives. But there's hardly anything that's written about corporate America's wrongdoing, because they can sue you and you can lose the newspaper.
But if you're going to journalism school, are you more likely to be concerned about, again, not that there's anything wrong with it, justice or injustice? Are you more concerned about saving the world than getting a high-paying job? Same thing with college professors.
No question.
Are you
about
more
it.
Interested in saving the world or molding young minds for the battle of hearts and minds? Are you more likely to be wanting to do that than if you are going to business school because you want to make a lot of money?
Well, I don't know about I don't know about molding minds, but certainly you're not. If you're going to go, it's like a vow of poverty. If you go to journalism school as opposed to law school or B school, you're taking a vow of poverty pretty much. And yes, you are doing it because you're probably think you're going to advance the cause of justice.
At the base of that, if you choose to do that, is there a built-in bias against those who do not do that? Because although you're doing it for, you believe, the right reasons, you want to make the world a better place. Built into that, is there a bias against people who go to business school or become successful in business because there's a little bit of jealousy that they're making more money than they are?
I think you're reading way too much. I think look at the heroes, the media, the liberal media, the punditry side, not the hard news side, is made out of Warren Buffett or Bill Gates now, who's become basically a philanthropist.
Steve Jobs.
And Steve Jobs. Well, these are heroes.
Another thing I want to point out, and this ties in with the discussion we were having, the fact that students are going more and more for majoring in business and economics doesn't negate the fact of you know, the liberal impact there. It's mistaken to think that business and industry in this country is overwhelmingly conservative. It isn't. Barack Obama received more Wall Street money than John McCain did in 2008.
For the record, I didn't say students were majoring in business and economics more heavily than in the past.
I thought you did.
I said they're moving into business careers.
Well, doesn't that imply that if they're majoring, if they're moving into business careers, that they would be majoring in those fields?
Not necessarily, no. I work at a liberal arts institution. We have a lot of students in business who go into business. We have a lot of liberal arts students who go into business.
Can I ask what the point is?
Pardon?
What was the point
you said? They're majoring in business and economics. That wasn't my point. That's not what I said.
Young people,
a lot of students are moving into business.
You said they were moving into business and economics.
Young people are also pretty good at knowing what the job market may be. Their parents talk to them. So back in, I also went to school during the quote-unquote revolution of the late 60s. Jobs were easy to come by. There was, you know, the Vietnam War was going strong. People got jobs when they got to college. So the idea of taking a flyer, traveling to Europe or something like that after you graduated, and you'd come back and you'd get a job. Well, by the 80s, things were much tighter. And people got much more career-minded in their education.
When I went to college, my professors, well, they were 100% liberal or way left, 100%. And I would say that I was conservative going into college. I was conservative coming out of college. But I do believe that I was a little more enlightened to at least viewing a different perspective of the world.
And it's not easy to do that.
It's not easy to do that. I mean, I think I overcame that, and I think I appreciate having. I mean, there's certain issues that really I'm very interested in now that when I was a freshman in school I was not interested in. And I went to school in the 60s when, as John remembers, there was a lot going on. There was a lot of opportunity for involvement. We've got callers on the line. You'll hear from them when we roll on from Chicago. From Walla Walla, Washington to Youngstown, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. And let's go to Youngstown right now, where Tom is listening to us on the Big 57 WKBN. Go ahead, Tom. Thanks for listening tonight.
Thank you, Bruce, and good evening to you and your guests. I have a comment question. The comment is when you're talking about Barack Obama taking credit for Osama bin Laden, I think a fair criticism in the fall could well be that he was sitting in the same room with the Joint Chiefs in real time, realizing that there was that downed stealth helicopter. As soon as the SEALs were taking off, he should have sent out cruise missiles, drones, or jets so that that multi-billion-dollar high-tech weapon wasn't unnecessarily compromised.
I don't know off the top of my head, Shirley, what the Joint Chiefs said about that. I mean, maybe that was not something that could be done at that time, given the timing of it all.
all I'm saying is I think that that is at least something that it would be a fair criticism from the standpoint of why wasn't it done? It hasn't been aired.
Okay.
As to if that was even considered, and even considered as a possibility before the fact. The other question I have for you and your guest is that it's my understanding that Scott Rasmussen came out with a poll today stating that Rick Santorum is the only candidate of the Republicans that are running that would beat Obama. Hmm. And I'd like to, you know, get your input of you and your guest as to whether that's going to have an impact as to the way things play out.
I did not see that particular poll, but here's my here's sort of my reaction. Santorum came from nowhere. I think he's staying in the race. By staying in the race, he helps Romney because he divides the conservative vote. I think in the debates he's done very, very well. I think he has a great story. He looks good, talks good. I think would be a strong candidate against Obama. But then when you get him off the issues that he talks about in the debate and you get him into some of the social issues, I think he would lose independents. I think he would lose moderate Republicans because some of his issues socially are, you know, are pretty far out there, at least for many even moderate conservatives. So I think he would be a tough sell. But I think to some independents, you know, I mean, I think he's youthful. He looks good. I think he may be running for a spot on the ticket because he consistently talks about, you know, where he came from, which is not far from you, which is Western Pennsylvania and Ohio, Northeast Ohio, and Michigan and Wisconsin. You talk about the sort of the blue collar Democratic swing areas that Ronald Reagan was able to connect to, again, with very strong and not dissimilar social positions than Rick Santorum. I think Rick Santorum could help him in those areas. And again, he's also a Roman Catholic. So I think that Rick Santorum could be a valuable part of that ticket, even though to some moderates, his social positions are anathema. I'll let everybody else, now that I've given you my two cents.
Well, I think right now that matchups between President Obama and individual Republican candidates don't mean anything because right now the Republicans have a heated primary battle. If you're a Gingrich supporter and they say, would you vote for Obama or Romney, you might be inclined not to say you'd vote for Romney because you don't want to give him any help in the primary. But once this is all sorted out and once the Republicans have a nominee, the overwhelming majority of Republicans are going to be behind that nominee. So, and I do agree with what you're saying about Santorum. I think that he's made a good presentation for himself, and I think he may be thinking ahead as a potential running mate.
John?
I agree also with what you said. He's very telegenic. This is really the first time I ever took a close look at him. Until he starts talking about, until he lines up with the Catholic bishops on contraceptives,
yeah.
I agree that a lot of people would fall away at that point, a lot of independents.
You summed it up very well, Bruce. The Rasmussen polls were all inundated with polls nowadays. They're particularly reliable, I think, even though they're accused of having a Republican bias. I don't think that really is persuasive. Secondly, we were talking off the air as well as on the air about the early 60s and the height of the Cold War. We don't have a Joint Chiefs of Staff in open opposition and publicly opposed to the president the way we did, for instance, during the Kennedy administration. I don't have any access to classified information, but I've been impressed by the way in which there has been a uniformity of view expressed during the Bush as well as the Obama administrations. Second-guessing, this was a high-risk operation. We should be grateful that it went off the way it did. Keep in mind that our relations with Pakistan are difficult, and I'm sure the administration's leaders were very mindful of that. The more we send in independent military strikes in a foreign country, the more we're risking our relations. Pakistan is crucial to us.
One other thing just about Santorum, I think at this moment in time, I think as a conservative alternative to Romney, with the states that lie ahead, and a firm believer that you win elections by playing offense, not defense, I think Rick Santorum is a stronger conservative challenger to Romney than is Newt Gingrich at this point.
He's also become a better debater, I think.
He's a much better debater. The last couple of debates, he's looked good. He makes the point. Again, he has a great personal story. He tells that story well. I know painting sort of the word pictures of his grandfather and growing up in western Pennsylvania and taking a district away makes a good point. The only person that really took a congressional seat away from a Democrat and a senatorial seat away from a Democrat. Again, he lost re-election, which again is the sort of the political black mark against him. But I would say right now, I think Rick Santorum is he's a stronger challenge to Mitt Romney than Newt Gingrich. And on that note, we are out of time. John Kuchelko, thanks very much for being with us. Art Sear, thank you as well. John McCarron, always good to have you with us as well. This program is a Jenny B production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. A reminder that this coming Wednesday night at 6 p.m. at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, we will present a public memorial service for the late Don Cornelius, the founder and creator of Soul Train, who took his life this past week. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.